The National Guard on city streets and senior officials sacked. Rumours of cancelled elections and attacks on the voting system. Grovelling public displays of loyalty from Republican leaders and Oval Office jokes about dictatorships. A president floating an illegal third term. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And today we're asking, how close is America's democracy to the edge? Well, if you paid attention to the news over the past week, you might be just a little bit worried. Have a listen to this fiery speech by Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin as he tore strips off British MP Nigel Farage at a committee hearing in Washington.
Come on over to America and see what Trump and MAGA are doing to destroy our freedom, kidnap college students off the street, ban books from our libraries, militarize our police and unleash them against our communities, take over our universities, wreck our professional civil service, and turn the government into a money-making machine for Trump and his family.
Donald Trump, of course, insists he has no interest in becoming a dictator.
You know, when I have some slob like Pritzker criticizing us before we even go there, I made the statement that next should be Chicago, because as you all know, Chicago's a killing field right now. And they don't acknowledge it. And they say, we don't need him. Freedom, freedom. He's a dictator. He's a dictator. A lot of people are saying maybe we like a dictator. I don't like a dictator. I'm not a dictator. I'm a man with great common sense and I'm a smart person. And when I see what's happening to our cities, and then you send in troops, instead of being praised, they're saying you're trying to take over the republic. These people are sick.
J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Chicago, has vowed to head straight to the courts if troops turn up in Chicago. And opponents like the Democratic Californian Governor Gavin Newsom claim the president is undermining the Constitution by deploying federal troops at home for domestic policing.
He is not above or beyond constitutional constraints. Constitution sets forth limits. The president is a constitutional officer. The president of the United States works under the Constitution. He is not a monarch, he is not a king, and he should stop acting like one.
So let's look at some of the other evidence from the past week alone that Donald Trump is verging on authoritarian. Did you see any of the coverage, oh Lord, of the cabinet meeting where secretaries of state lined up to heap praise on their leader rather than talking about policies?
You have the overwhelming mandate from the American people. You're restoring confidence in government.
Thank you for the opportunity to work for you. You made this country safe. Mr. President, I invite you to see your big, beautiful face on a banner in front of the Department of Labor, because you are really the transformational president of the American worker.
And there's only one thing I wish for, that that noble committee finally gets its act together and realizes that you are the single finest candidate since this Nobel Award was ever talked about.
This is the greatest cabinet working for the greatest president. And I just want to say thank you. I'm having the time of my life. Working for you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
With an eye to next year's midterm elections, there were continued attacks in recent days on the voting system, and President Trump even moved U.S. Space Command from Colorado to Alabama because of his opposition to postal voting.
Space Command headquarters will move to the beautiful locale of a place called Huntsville, Alabama, forever to be known from this point forward as Rocket City. So Huntsville, Alabama, we love Alabama. I only won it by about 47 points. I don't think that influenced my decision, though, right? That didn't, right? The problem I have with Colorado, one of the big problems, they do mail-in voting. They went to all mail-in voting. So they have automatically crooked elections. And we can't have that. When a state is for mail-in voting, that means they want dishonest elections, because that's what that means. So that played a big factor also.
And then there was the order to rename the Pentagon, which is, of course, the Department of Defense, to the Department of War to celebrate the president's 200th day in office last Friday. It must be said, there is judicial pushback against some of these moves. A federal judge ruled that withholding billions of dollars from Harvard University breached the university's right to free speech. Trump had, of course, accused the Ivy League institution of anti-Semitism, woke radical left ideologies and racial bias against white people. We'll see where that goes. So regardless of whether you like or dislike Donald Trump, it is pretty inarguable that his second term is at least testing, pushing the seams of America's checks and balances. Well, Daniel Geary is a historian at Trinity College Dublin. He's here to help us separate precedent, and there is some precedent, from power grab, and tell us what this all means for US democracy. You're very welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
I'm always conscious when I'm talking about Trump that there are those who support him or like how he operates who will accuse the media of being quite hysterical in their coverage of Donald Trump, his personality and his approach to power. But do you think any rational, sane person who follows US politics would say yes, there has definitely been overreach by the president this time around?
Oh, I certainly think so. I mean, and it's been quite different, I think, from Trump's first term, where perhaps there, you know, you could say there was a certain hysteria with the whole Russiagate and people thinking that Trump was a Russian agent. But I think his intentions were plain enough in the first term, and he's been, had the power to, I suppose, enact a lot more of his agenda this time around.
And some of the checks and balances that were in place first time round worked, and he had more dissent at cabinet, and he seemed to allow voices who disagreed with him to remain in positions of power.
Well, you have to remember, in 2016, Trump was not the preferred candidate of the Republican establishment whatsoever. And so when he came into power, the Republican Party at that time, you know, had a independent identity, I suppose, apart from the MAGA movement. And that's just not true anymore. There just aren't any Republicans anymore that are publicly skeptical of Trump. So he's got his whole party behind him, and he didn't have that in the first term.
So I'm wondering how wide-ranging and at what level are you hearing conversations and concerns being voiced about the overreach?
I think it's very concerning. And, you know, if you step back from the daily news, when there's, you know, one thing after another, it seems this is the theme of the second Trump administration, is authoritarianism and just how far will he be able to go. I myself, while under no illusions about what Trump's intentions were, you know, was surprised by just how swiftly he moved and just how far he's gone.
I mean, he did joke, didn't he, in the Oval Office, I think it was last week, oh, you know what, maybe I'm a dictator, maybe people actually want a dictator, maybe that'll be, you know, almost good for America. Now, I do think it was, like a lot of what Trump says, a flippant comment that he hadn't actually, I think, put an awful lot of thought into, but it is certainly the style of leadership which he seems to admire.
It is. I mean, you know, he has great fondness for other kind of autocrats, if you like, and this is how he likes to do his business. I mean, it's extraordinary because in the American Constitution, you know, the president is not meant to have all the power. And yet you have a situation where the legislature is controlled by Republicans who are, you know, afraid of criticizing Trump. So they're essentially rubber stamping things. They've given up their role in the checks and balances. And you have a judiciary that at the lower levels has many sort of Democrats, liberals, or even, you know, Trump skeptical Republicans in them. But at the top level, the Supreme Court is the most conservative Supreme Court in history, which includes three justices appointed by Trump himself.
So let's look at some of the ways in which Donald Trump has been flexing that presidential muscle. You have to, I think, start with this list of senior officials that he has either fired or sidelined since he took office. It's quite staggering. I'm looking at the governor of the Federal Reserve, Lisa Cook, and his attempts to fire her, the CDC chief, Susan Menares, and the Bureau of Labour Statistics, Erica McIntyre-Finn, who also was accused of trying to rig statistics and was gone. How unusual is this? And what does it tell us about what the president can and can't actually do?
I think it's quite unusual. I mean, you could find precedents where presidents have tried to remove, you know, certain administrative officials that, you know, were opposed to their agenda, but nothing on quite this scale.
So give me some of those earlier examples of where it has happened and it was, you know, legitimate or it is authorized under the powers that the president has.
Well, I think in the Nixon administration, I mean, there was famously his removal of attorney generals until he could get ones that would comply with his desires. But of course, that failed, you know.
Quite spectacularly.
Yes. In the end. I mean, I think if you look in the realm of foreign policy in particular, though, you know, you'll see ever since World War II, you know, an expanding power of the president. I mean, in the U.S. Constitution, the right ability to declare war is left in the hands of Congress, but the wars that the U.S. have fought have not been declared since then. So the presidency, and this is both Democrats and Republicans, have effectively, you know, usurped that role in foreign policy, and that kind of powerful executive branch. I think initially the founders of the Constitution intended the legislature to be, you know, the most important branch. That's the place where people have, you know, democratic debates. But the presidency has grown in power. So while Trump has exploited that as no other president has, I think he's also building on a long-term trend.
So let's look at somebody like Lisa Cook, who is clearly trying to fight and to stop her being removed. Does he actually have the authority to do that? Is that within his remit?
I mean, no, I don't think he has the authority to do a lot of the things that he's doing, although ultimately he's doing them anyway, and he's daring anybody to stop him. I mean, the Federal Reserve in particular is meant to have a certain independence from politics. I mean, it's not an accident. Lisa Cook is the first African-American woman to be on the Fed board, that he would remove her. Yeah, but I think this is an example of him just seeing how far he can go. But I think the Fed has a status that will make him more difficult to push this through the Supreme Court than with other firings of executive bodies that, you know, should be independent, but which he's been able to get away with a lot.
And I think it is interesting when you look at the person who's replaced the CDC chief. It is somebody from RFK Jr.'s administration, his deputy, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It is somebody who is a, you know, Trump loyalist, a fan of Trump. He very much replaces them with sycophants.
He does. Loyalty is the number one quality. I mean, you know, we see this across the Trump administration. Of course, there's a danger to that too. You know, in that if you're surrounded by loyalists, you don't have people to, you know, to tell you otherwise. And with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where Trump is, you know, upset about reporting economic statistics, he can have people report whatever economic statistics they want, but Americans will know if they're out of work, if they're struggling financially, if the prices are going up, you know, so yeah.
His difficulty there was that the stats coming out from that bureau said that there were job losses.
Exactly.
And yeah. He didn't like that, and
yes.
He disagreed with it.
He's especially worried about, you know, that this will show the negative financial effects of his tariffs, which I think are quite could be quite damaging to the American economy. But I mean, you can cover that up in statistics, but people will know in their lives what the changes are. And so if you're, you know, this is a kind of a emperor has no clothes situation where if you fire the people who would tell you different, then they only have people tell you what you want to believe, you will become more and more disconnected from political reality.
Yeah, but you'll centralize loyalty and you weaken all of those institutional controls that have always been in place to try and keep presidents in check.
Sure, yeah.
Let's look at the National Guard going onto the streets in the United States and cities like LA and Washington and now potentially in Chicago. That to me felt pretty extreme. In what situations is the National Guard historically deployed?
Well, the main one that, you know, when you think about the National Guard being used for domestic use was during the uprisings, the 1960s in various American cities where the National Guard was called in to restore order. It generally did not do a very good job of it, often made things worse. So there are certain cases in which the National Guard can be used in that way and have been, but there are not uprisings on the American streets. There aren't riots going on. Trump's justification for calling in the National Guard, saying that, you know, simply that he's in there to deal with crime rates going up, which is not even true, you know, is not what the National Guard is meant to be used for at all. And it's certainly not meant to be used when, you know, the governors of the states or the mayors of the cities don't want it there. I mean, in the 1960s, the National Guard was working with the police and working with the local authorities.
Yeah, and we saw the Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker accusing the president last week of being authoritarian, of trying to circumvent democracy, militarize our cities, and end elections. So I think it's quite clear from him now, he is a Democrat, that he did not want to see the National Guard deployed onto his street.
Absolutely. The Chicago mayor has said, you know, the police aren't going to cooperate with the National Guard. So how does it even work? I'm not sure. But I think the other thing that needs to be added to the equation is the role of ICE, the immigration authorities. And that's really, I think, what is driving a lot of this sort of authoritarian crackdown in cities, that many of these cities have essentially permitted undocumented immigrants to live and work there without attempting to crack down it at all. And Trump is seeking to crack down. And so ICE is going to workplaces and just rounding people up that look like they might not be citizens, effectively people who are Latinos, you know, so it's effective racial profiling, you know, round them up, take them in, see if they're citizens, and if not, deport them. And if you're going to achieve Trump's ambitious goals of how many million undocumented migrants he wants to deport, you have to use authoritarian measures. You know, there's no other way around it. But I think that is, you know, the National Guard being called in, we'll see what happens with that. But so far, it has really been ICE that has been the main agency that is making authoritarianism on the streets of American cities a reality.
Let's look at the universities. I remember covering the dispute with Harvard this time last year. There's been a few of them that have been in Trump's firing line. You called it McCarthyism on steroids. Not pulling your punches there, Dan. What was the upshot of all of that?
Well, some of these, you know, it's ongoing, effectively, because Trump has made deals with certain universities like Columbia, but he doesn't hold to his deal. So he just comes back and asks for more. This is his method of negotiating. And he's gone after more and more, you know, universities in the University of California system. So I think this is simply ongoing threats by the Trump administration to pull money from universities, money appropriated by Congress that he doesn't really have the right to pull, but he's doing it anyway in order to force universities to kind of conform in various ways to what he wants them to be doing.
He has also launched military strikes abroad, like the one we saw in Iran at the nuclear facilities, without asking Congress. Is that overstepping the line, or is that one of the powers that the occupant of the Oval Office has?
It is overstepping, but it's not surprising. I mean, in the sense that this is something that presidents have been doing for decades, ever since the Cold War period. So he's not unusual in that, although it is both via the Constitution, I think, and via congressional legislation passed after the Vietnam War. You know, it is actually overstepping. But, you know, people don't really think of it as new, because this is something so many American presidents, the power that they've wielded, that they've just taken as their own.
So he's not the first to do that.
Not at all.
No. Some of the biggest resistance that we have seen to Trump's overreach has come from the courts system in the United States. And we saw the Federal Appeals Court declaring the tariffs policy to be illegal. But how successful, or perhaps unsuccessful, have they been in actually trying to restrain Trump or control his overreach? Completely unsuccessful?
We don't know yet, I think, is the answer, because a lot of these cases are still working their way to the Supreme Court. But the signs are, I suppose, if the signs of restraining Trump are not good. In some cases, the Supreme Court has just allowed things to go ahead, even as the court cases are winding up, so that, like, yes, I mean, the USAID agency, which, you know, distributes foreign aid, and including, you know, vital medical services for people throughout the globe, which was just dismantled by Trump. You know, the Supreme Court hasn't decided yet whether it can do that, but it has allowed the firings to go ahead. So even if they come back at a later date and say, well, you know, you can't do this, it's gone. You know, that doesn't exist anymore, really.
But we did see, I suppose, some restrictions in Washington after those arrests from the National Guard. I think there was over 1,000 arrests. And when those individuals came before the courts just refusing to indict the the individual, simply saying, you know, the evidence isn't strong enough. The charge being put before us is, you know, not going to stand up in a court of law. So they were able to demonstrate some of their strength there.
I think that's true. And, you know, at the lower levels of the courts, I think there's a lot of resistance to Trump. I think it's just more on the bigger cases, which will ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court. Trump has a lot more support. But some of these issues are going to be closer calls, I suppose, and we just don't know where the court's going to come down just yet, although I wouldn't be overly hopeful that it's going to, you know, be a major restraining influence on Trump.
In all of this, Dan, it appears that the Democrats are barely lifting a finger to oppose them. I was actually thinking last night, who have I heard from the Democrats speak out strongly? And I couldn't think of five names. I think the Californian governor, Gavin Newsom, did come to mind.
Yep.
Because we've heard him being unequivocal in his condemnation of Trump. But other than that, not many. Is the weakness of the Democrats really playing into his hands?
Absolutely. I mean, the many mainstream Democrats have seemed just taken aback, clueless, unsure how to respond. This includes the congressional leadership. With that said, I mean, there have been grassroots mobilizations. There was the No Kings movement. Certain governors have been outspoken. And also, I suppose, Bernie Sanders and AOC have been going around barnstorming the country and getting pretty large crowds.
And within his own party, we have seen him threaten Republican lawmakers with primary challenges if they don't all fall into line. He does seem to have an iron grip on the Republican Party and on that MAGA movement.
Well, yes, he does. I think there are evidence of kind of rifts with the MAGA movement over certain things like the bombing of Iran. There have been sort of interesting rifts developing, but I mean, ultimately,
but it never leads to anything.
It hasn't led to anything as of yet. And certainly, if you're a Republican politician, you know, you need Trump's endorsement or you just don't have a chance of winning your primary.
People are increasingly asking if the U.S. is sliding towards authoritarianism. And we've seen books from really influential writers like Anne Applebaum making this case. How close are we, Dan, to that being a reality?
I think very close. I mean, you know,
really?
It depends in part on your, you know, perspective. I mean, if you are someone who's getting rounded up in these ICE raids, if you're someone who's an outspoken Palestinian activist who's been, you know, disappeared from a college campus, even though you have a legal right to be in the country, you know, there's a lot of authoritarianism already in the works. I guess the broader question is, what methods will be used for Trump to hold on to power? Because I don't think that what he's doing is going to be popular or is popular with the majority of Americans. I think in a free and fair election in 2018, the Democrats would probably stand to win gains, even as disorganized as many of them are, simply because, you know, a lot of Americans who voted for Trump, they didn't want tariffs. They didn't want, you know, ICE raids. They didn't want attacks on universities. That these weren't his popular, you know, issues. Even some of them who wanted a crackdown on immigration when they see what it looks like, don't necessarily like it in practice. So I don't think this is going to prove something that he is going to be create a sort of enduring Republican majority. And so with that in mind, you know, what authoritarian steps will they take to hold on to power? That'll be the big question. And we, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I think there will be efforts to hold on to power that are undemocratic. How far they will go, I'm not sure.
But you sound fearful.
Well, yes. I mean, I think you'd have to be if you're being realistic. I would guess that the steps would be short of just simply suspending the U.S. Constitution, say, and ruling as a dictator. But there's many things that can be done, you know, short of that to try to rig the system, to intimidate, you know, opponents, intimidate Democratic voters and the like.
Looking at other countries where we have seen democracy and norms slowly being eroded, what lessons do you think Americans should be learning from those countries before it's too late?
Well, I think they should be properly alarmed in the first instance. And I think they also need to think about what the alternative is. And I think this has been the Democrats' problem in a way, is that many of them don't have a genuine alternative to Trumpism. So there is such discontent, I suppose, with the political and economic system, that if you can't speak to that from a Democratic perspective, small d and big D, then you have nothing to put up against, you know, Trumpism. And we see this in other countries, you know, throughout the world. This has been the popularity of the rise of the populist right. I don't think the sort of old school centrism can defeat the populist right. I think you need a kind of a populism of the left. If you look at the popularity of Bernie Sanders, of AOC, this is where the energy is on the party. It's where the energy has been since 2016, frankly. Biden co-opted a lot of that energy in 2020. To his credit, he recognized it. We'll have to wait for the 2028 Democratic primary, but I think there'd be a very good chance of a candidate from the party's left wing, not just making a serious run at it like Sanders did, but actually winning the nomination.
Daniel Geary, Mark Pickett, Professor in U.S. History at the Trinity College, Dublin. Thanks so much for joining me in News Talk Daily today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, that's it from the podcast today. Thanks, as always, for your company. If you enjoy News Talk Daily, and I hope you do, please follow us and give us a rating. That'll make sure you never miss an episode. So until tomorrow morning, from me, Ciara Doherty. Goodbye.